Are we ready to start the meeting? Okay. Okay, I'm going to call to order the Board of Directors Climate Protection Committee meeting. Roll call.
On the roll for the Climate Protection Committee meeting of September 21st, 2017, Director Abe-Koga, Director Joya.
Here.
Director Haggerty, Director Hudson, Director Rice.
Here.
Director Ross, Director Wagon Connect, Committee Vice Chair Sinks.
Here.
Committee Chair Barrett.
Here.
We are one committee member short of a quorum.
Director Abe-Koga, just...
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Pledge of Allegiance. Is there any public comment on non-agendized items?
I do have one card, Madam Chair. Janet Stromberg.
Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the Climate Protection Committee. Janet Stromberg from 350 Bay Area. And I apologize in advance. I'm going to be on the wonky side today, kind of verbiage.
You wonky?
Anyway. My first statement is to point out that thousands of constituents, particularly those living in disproportionately impacted areas from air pollution, from stationary sources, believe that district staff simply rubber stamp permits. As a former district permit engineer myself, I know this is not true. I know staff pay very close attention to correctly apply regulatory requirements to every project application. Staff is suggesting that Rule 1118 will cap emissions and that it can't directly cap PM and GHG emissions on stationary sources. This is simply not true. Add-on controls, particularly afterburners, can reduce toxic emissions while increasing PM and GHGs. The New Source Review Program is elegantly designed. Its purpose is to limit emission increases from new and modified sources, that is, to establish caps. Built into the framework are provisions to ensure conditions placed on pollution sources to limit only to limit emissions require cost-effective, proven technologies. It is robust and flexible as new technologies become proven to work and are cost effective, they become the norm for future projects. I wrote this on the bus. I didn't get it fixed. Eventually, information gained through NSR is used to adopt new rules to require emission reductions from existing sources. It's an elegant program when used correctly. As I said, the purpose of NSR is to limit emission increases. It is decidedly not an emission reduction program. Yet this is what your staff is essentially suggesting by hiding behind AB 398 to refuse to incorporate GHGs in the NSR program. You will be asked to adopt amendments to the NSR rule on October 18th. The Climate Protection Committee needs to have a robust discussion about this before the board considers these amendments. Your primary regulatory authority is over stationary sources. You can't give up your authority. We already know that the worst pollutants impacting people and the climate are PM and GHGs, which mainly result from combustion, as most other, well, anyway. You get the point. I'm urging you to put the brakes on the permit rule amendments and really examine the issues. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else from the public? Okay, fine. Thank you. Approval of the minutes for July 20th. Any comments? Mm-hmm. Can we approve the minutes as submitted?
So moved.
Thank you.
Second.
Okay. Any objection? None. Thank you. We have had a request from staff to put item number 4 after item number 5. So if there's no opposition, we'll go to item number 5, the update on the Air District basin-wide methane strategy.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the Climate Protection Committee. This morning, staff's going to be presenting to you an overview of our methane strategy, focusing on the scientific investigations about methane in our region and the things that we can do to reduce it, how important it is as a climate forcer. And I'm pleased to say that this morning we have Adanya Zamora, a senior engineer in our new Office of Policy Rules and Strategic Policy. We're going to get that right eventually. Office of Rules and Strategic Policy. So thank you, Adanya.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Barrett and members of the committee. As Jean kindly introduced me, my name is Adanya Zamora, and I'm a senior engineer in the newly formed Office of Rules and Strategic Policy. And I'll be providing a brief update on the basin-wide methane strategy. I'll start with the motivation, why focusing on methane emissions, and provide background on the methane emissions in our region. And then I'll jump right in into the methane strategy, and I'll describe the different efforts that are contained within it with a focus on the regulatory efforts. So I'll be talking about the highest priority rules. And I'll finish the presentation with the implementation timeline. So why focus on methane? Simply put, it is a high-impact strategy to slow the rate of climate change with co-benefits, and that is within the full capability of the Air District. Why is it a high-impact strategy? Mainly because of two factors. Methane is roughly 34 times more potent than carbon dioxide, or CO2, and it is also removed faster from the atmosphere, on average around 12 years versus a range of 20 to 200 years for CO2. Those two factors combined make reducing methane emissions very powerful, because we're removing a very powerful GHG from the atmosphere that has a very large near-term impact. Reducing methane emissions also has co-benefits. It provides public health and further climate benefits from the reduction of climate criteria and toxic co-pollutants. And it has economic benefits from recovered energy and other high-value products, such as compost. Finally, air districts have a critical role in meeting the state's methane emission reduction goal of 40% by 2030. And the air district has this full suite of actions, both regulatory and non-regulatory, available within its authorities to act on methane, which is significant in our region. So here is basically a pie chart of our current inventory, our 2015 estimated emissions are around 4 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. Recycling and waste account for roughly 58% of that, with landfills providing most of those emissions. Agriculture and farming follows with around 20%. Most of that is animal waste, is coming from animal waste. And finally, the industrial sector provides the next largest piece with 14%. And a large percentage of that is coming from the natural gas distribution. Having said that, a key point here is that our methane inventory still has large uncertainties embedded into it. Here I will discuss some of the latest scientific findings. Recent Bay Area top-down studies have found that the methane emissions are around two times higher than Air District inventory for 2015. Basically, these are estimates based on measurements, which is where it's called top-down, versus our inventory, which is based on calculation using our standard methods. The second study has found that biological methane dominates methane emissions in the Bay Area with around 82%, followed by natural gas. If I can direct you to the chart, this is from the second study. It's basically showing us methane emissions by sector, both from prior model assumptions before the study and then after the studies with the measurement-based estimates. And you can see that a lot of the underestimation that of methane is coming from the landfills. Now, there are still knowledge gaps in the literature, and we have seen indications that refineries may emit more than previously thought, as well as composting and anaerobic digestion operations. Now that we've discussed why it's important to focus on methane and how are the methane emissions in our region, let's jump right into the methane strategy and how the Air District is addressing methane reduction. The methane strategy is simply a coordination framework to coordinate all efforts to reduce methane together and promote collaboration. I'll describe some of the elements here. On top, we have the GHG monitoring and measuring program, and that works very closely with the methane emissions inventory. And basically, they feed information to each other, and they address the large uncertainties that are right now in our inventory. All that knowledge is fed into the different efforts throughout the district. We have rule development efforts. Those are rules and regulations and best practices. We have planning and climate efforts, which include model ordinances, climate action plans, et cetera. And those overlap with strategic incentive efforts, as well as enforcement efforts and other divisions. Now, the methane strategy is using different tools to promote collaboration and optimize this process. We've convened a methane expert panel to advise the Air District staff during the development of the methane strategy. The panel is comprised of subject matter experts from academia, public agencies, industry, and NGOs. And meeting topics will include composting, oil and gas sector, landfills, anaerobic digestion, etc. We've also started a research integration process to streamline the coordination of research efforts across methane topics and leverage those findings into the strategy. And finally, we've initiated a stakeholder engagement process to provide an opportunity for stakeholders to provide early input into different aspects of the strategy, such as prioritization or specific rule input. Now that we've discussed how the methane strategy is coordinating all these efforts, let's focus on one of the elements, methane research efforts. There are two sort of programs inside methane research efforts. One is led by the Air District, and one is external studies that we are funding and or collaborating on. Within the efforts led by the Air District, there are two key areas. There's the fixed site GHG monitoring network, which tracks long-term regional patterns of GHG concentrations. There are four monitoring sites, one background and three others that are sort of downstream from the urban core, and they measure CO2, methane, carbon monoxide, and water vapor. And the data can be found in our website. The second element to the research efforts that are led in-house is a GHG research ban. The purpose of the ban is to identify emission hotspots, to do source attribution, and to keep improving our emissions inventory. The research ban is capable of fast measurements of CO2, methane, and nitrous oxide. It can do source apportionment using chemical tracers, and it's currently conducting preliminary leak surveys in different sources to fine-tune its equipment and to refine its methods. Now I'm going to jump into another key area of effort within the methane reduction actions. These are the planning and climate efforts. For the sake of time, I will highlight one key item in each of these sectors, but I'll be happy to answer any questions you have, or Abby actually can certainly answer them much better than I can. On the water sector, the Air District will provide advocacy for funding to develop green infrastructure in wastewater treatment facilities. Within the waste sector, the Air District will develop model ordinances and policies to reduce green waste going to the landfills. Within the buildings sector, the Air District will seek to promote natural gas end uses such as space heating and water heating in buildings to electricity. And finally, within the agriculture sector, it will develop case studies on small-scale use of dairy digesters. So those are just some examples, but there are clearly a whole range of efforts that are being undertaken under planning and climate efforts. And now I'll provide a brief overview on the regulatory efforts. Here we see a methane rule development map. In general terms, methane can come from two distinct sources, oil and gas, or what we call fossil fuel or old methane, and biological or new methane. The first rule that we are developing, it's a general methane leak prohibition, and it expands both of these types of methane. We will then focus on the oil and gas sector, on natural gas processing and distribution, and these are efforts that have been initiated at the California Public Utility Commission through SB 1371, and we're certainly participating in those efforts. We're also developing a crude oil and natural gas production rule, which I'll describe briefly a bit later in the presentation, and we are definitely looking at refineries, sort of in a research phase right now. On the biological side, we're initiating a composting operations rules. We are also starting to look at landfills and amending Regulation 834. And other efforts that we'll be looking into are anaerobic digestion facilities and wastewater treatment facilities. Now I'll describe the three highest priority rules that we are currently developing. First is Regulation 13.2, General Methane Leak Prohibition. It will establish a limit for methane leaks across all Bay Area sources. A little bit of background on this is during 2015-2016, there was a very large leak, as you are probably all aware, in Aliso Canyon, and it released close to 2.4 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. And so we are trying to sort of think ahead and establish a rule that will allow us to take prompt action in the case of large leaks in our district. There is currently a rule, Air District Rule 8.2, which prohibits large leaks of organic emissions, around 15 pounds per day throughout the district, but it exempts natural gas currently. So there would be nothing we could do with that rule for methane. So the purpose of this rule is to serve as a backstop while source-specific rules are adopted. How will it work? The current thinking, and this is we're definitely seeking input from stakeholders, is that operators will need to fix leaks that are above 10,000 ppm and 10 pounds per hour. So now I'll describe the next rule, Reg 8, Rule 37, Crude Oil and Natural Gas Production. The purpose of amending this rule, which is currently a rule, is to address methane, volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, and toxic emissions from smaller oil and gas facilities that would be exempted from the Air Resources Board's oil and gas rule. this current rule that we have, it limits organic compounds from natural gas and crude oil facilities, but exempts methane. As you may be aware, ARB passed an oil and gas rule back in March 2017. However, this rule was designed for bigger facilities. It has a production exemption, which basically results in covering less than 25% of the GHG emissions from our district due to these exemptions, because we do tend to have smaller facilities in our district. However, the rule does allow air districts to implement firmer requirements. And so the idea would be to sort of adopt and strengthen ARB's rule. How will it work? We will consider a lower leak threshold to achieve cost-effective methane and VOC reductions and to protect public health. And we would be removing the methane exemption from the rule. A bit of exciting sort of follow-up to this rule is that we are conducting an active well pilot study during the fall of 2017 to better characterize methane, VOCs, and toxic emissions from active oil and gas wells in the Bay Area. It will approximately cover 10% of active wells, around 10 out of 105 that we have. And it will use a range of instruments to do screening and also test VOC, toxics, and methane. The key sources that we'll be looking at will be the production facility itself, which includes all the components, wellhead, separator, the dehydration unit, etc. We'll be looking at produced water and condensate tanks and vacuum trucks. And finally, a new rule. We'll be looking at composting operations, particularly controlling methane and VOCs from composting. A bit of background on this is the state goal of 75% waste diversion by 2020 is greatly increasing the composting volumes in our region. As a result, we've seen an increase in odor complaints from facilities handling organic waste. I believe Director Kino has given an update on the situation before. And so this rule will streamline permitting by proposing a set of requirements that would be uniform across all composting facilities. The facilities that will be affected will be composting operations, both standalone and at landfills, wood chipping and grinding facilities, and organic waste handling, such as material stockpiling. How will it work? Again, these are all preliminary thinking on how these rules will be developing. Implement best management practices for smaller operations and require emissions control equipment for the larger operations. Finally, I'll conclude with an implementation timeline for some of these efforts that I've discussed. In 2017, we'll be looking to... So basically, we have been participating in the CPUC, the California Public Utility Commission, leak abatement program development, which addresses the natural gas system in the whole of California. And we've been sort of a party in that and provided input. Phase one has ended, and now they're on to phase two. Phase one resulted in some required best management practices. Phase two will sort of make it a bit more technical and move it towards firmer goals. And so we have participated in phase one in 2017, and we plan to continue participating in the next years. We also plan to finish the implementation planning for the methane strategy in this year. And then we plan to bring to the board in 2017 the general methane leak prohibition, the oil and gas amended rule 837, and the new rule composting operations. And that is everything that I had. Thank you for your attention.
So you said you'd bring that to the board in 17, but you meant 18. The control measures?
The last three. Oh, yes. Yes, excuse me. I meant 2018.
Okay.
Apologies.
Thank you. Yeah. That's all right. Okay, so I guess I'll open this to the public comment first.
Do we have questions?
Do you want questions first?
Yeah, I have a few questions.
Okay, let's have the questions from.
Thanks for the presentation. So I have general questions and some specific questions. So the state and the Air Resources Board have developed a sort of a short-lived climate pollutant strategy, and AB 32 is sort of discusses also some of this as well. So to what extent are you coordinating with statewide efforts on methane? I mean, it seems to me there's a lot of work being done at ARB.
Absolutely.
So how are you coordinating that?
Staff works very closely with the staff at the Air Resources Board. Our clean air plan also coordinated with the short-lived climate pollutant strategy at the state. Certainly we are working with ARB on their rulemaking and expanding upon it where it's appropriate for our district. The ARB staff participate with us in our stakeholder groups and focus groups. So
I mean, like one of the things I noticed here, one of the sort of strategies you identify under waste is model ordinances and policies to reduce green waste going to landfills. Given that there's a state policy already that says the goal of 75% waste diversion by 2020, and obviously it's going to get ramped up in the future, I'm sure. How are you seeing that there's a need then to have model ordinances to achieve that goal or to go beyond that goal? Let's talk about that.
Okay. I think that I'll add.
In other words, you don't think that state goal in and of itself is going to cause us to get there, and there needs to be some local actions to get there?
I think that it's helpful to have groups locally be thinking about how to get there. That's part of it, but the other part is, as Danya mentioned, we are having some local issues in terms of the changes in the waste stream, and that's a good thing for us to help with locally in terms of the odors, because it affects our staff and our response to our constituents. So I think it's really trying to help locally within our region, help the state meet those goals, and also at the same time meet our goals.
Right.
So that's really
You have this sort of tension between meeting the state goal of greater diversion, which is, of course, causing more composting, and composting is a good thing because it's a use of a product and it diverts it from the landfill. It's more about the control mechanisms, which will be costly to control the odors. So, and a lot of these composting operations are happening at facilities that were not necessarily originally permitted for composting, right? They were maybe permitted to be a transfer station or a landfill. They may be nearer some residences than you would like, and then they add composting to their local permit. So city and county may say, okay, do the composting over there, and that causes odor issues, right? So maybe even best management, maybe even practices about siting, I would think siting of these facilities as well, because we're going to need composting facilities. We just need them sited in the right places. The other thing, so 70% of the methane in the Bay Area comes from two sources. Animal waste from 20% is animal waste and farming, approximately, right? Because almost all that is agriculture, farming is animal waste. And then and half of it comes from landfills. So do we have a breakdown of what activities at landfills cause most of the methane, right? You're talking a typical landfill as opposed to the other activities that go on at the landfill as well. So do you have more data about that?
I think decomposition of the waste is the major source.
So it's decomposition of the waste in the landfill itself that is producing that. So 50% comes from that. So I like to sort of think, so what's the strategy you're focusing on for these two areas? For the two largest sources, I know you have other rules, which are good, but the two absolute largest sources that contribute to 70%, I didn't see what, I know there's been some state discussion about policies at dairies and things like that. So what are you looking at with regard to animal waste at farms, and what are you looking at at the landfills themselves? You talked about composting, which is, one part of it, but not, I didn't understand what was being done at landfills itself.
So we start initially, Director Jari, initially we started off with, let's do a landfill rule.
Right.
And then we dug into it a little bit and figured out, well, there's this whole system of composting, right. anaerobic digestion, right. right? And it's all changing, right? So we needed to focus on where the real pain points are right now. And the real pain point right now is with composting, because the volume of the green waste that's coming into the composting system is exceeding the capacity of the system. So the first step is to establish some best practices right. for composting.
Makes sense, right?
Right, and then we'll move on to what do we need to do to continue cleaning up the land.
So what percent of methane is coming from composting?
We don't know.
So the 50%, is it from landfill, does not include composting, or composting as a subset of that?
One of the things you'll note on Adanya's chart is that it doesn't say landfills particular, it says recycling and waste. Now,
right, but it does, but then you look under here and it says right. landfills, it says landfills 88%. So right. I was looking at that.
And we don't have kind of, like you said, it's decomposition of waste. We don't
Got
really
it.
Have that.
So we don't know whether it's the composting part of it, the decomposition of the waste, traditional right. municipal waste, so we don't know. So that's where it seems to me that's a really important thing eventually to understand, because then we know where to put our efforts.
Exactly. There's a lot of things about methane we don't know.
Got
and
it.
That's why we're doing this big research project.
But the state's looking at this too, so you are coordinating. It just seems, here is what it seems. I sit at air board meetings where there's all this research going on, and I'm just wanting to make sure that the research we're doing isn't, I'm sure the goal isn't to be to duplicate the research that someone else is doing.
Absolutely.
Because I can tell you the state Absolutely. Is focusing a lot Absolutely. On this.
And you know why we're all focusing okay. on this methane issue? We haven't focused on it before.
Right.
Because it isn't, all the other VOCs or many other VOCs are precursors to ozone. And we have had an ozone regulatory program for decades.
Right.
And methane is not very reactive and it right. doesn't really do much to contribute to ozone. So we haven't focused on it, and now the state is focusing on
right.
it. We're focusing.
So you're
on
piggybacking it. On that those efforts.
We are coordinating right. with state right. absolutely.
And the
it's
last,
really important.
Then the last thing on animal waste, which is 20%. What's sort of what are you? What are we thinking about there?
Before I jump to that question, can yep. I add a little bit to Jean's?
Yeah,
So we.
Yeah, no. There were folks showing up at some state meetings saying we should change our diet. You're right. That would change. That would do a lot, right?
Just two quick things I would mention is
stop buying cheese pizza. That's what they said. No, they said most of the. I bet you can contribute a lot of methane to the process to get to cheese pizza. Anyway.
Director Joya, so I was going to add that when I mentioned the optimization tools for the strategy, we do have a methane expert panel. We have a person from ARB, which is connected to the whole composting, mm-hmm. landfill, anaerobic digestion field, and she's in touch mm-hmm. with her supervisor, so she'll be participating mm-hmm. in our expert panel. And we also have been coordinating and listening in on ARB's big study with CEC, the big methane survey mm-hmm. that's going statewide. And we've been in conversations with them about our research efforts as well. And they're mm-hmm. very eager to sort of exchange information. Just wanted to add that.
Great. Thank you.
And then for the
animal waste yeah.
I think if you, yeah.
I'm serious when I said people actually showed up and said people should change their diet and buy less cheese pizza. And we heard that. But anyway.
I'm not going to go into that.
Yeah, because we won't go into that. Right.
My boss and I disagree on.
You like cheese pizza, right?
I like meat. I don't eat much.
Okay,
you know,
right.
But to the point of animal waste, the issue we have with animal waste in the Bay Area is we don't have a lot of big concentrated feeding operations,
yeah.
right? So if you got a lot of cows on the hills, there's no practical way to control it. It's not like the San Joaquin Valley where they right. have a lot of these big dairies. So we have a few.
There's some up in Sonoma and Marin,
yeah,
those dairies.
Yeah, but they're medium
right.
sized
right.
in the dairy world. And so it's more right. of a how can we help you kind of thing rather than
right.
a regulatory
right.
mandate.
And they're actually starting to engage in some good practices, actually.
Right. Absolutely,
Strauss.
They are. And,
right.
and thanks, you know, with help from the folks in Abby's group, I think that's
right.
moving along.
Okay. I just raised those because I know you're working on rules which are good in from sources that are a much, much smaller part of it. And I know those are always easy. Those are always easy targets. We're going to do a rule here and it's for a source that's maybe 5% of it. And as opposed to, you know, I know you're thinking about how we're dealing where the source is 50% of it.
Before we left the landfill topic, I did want to point out that for decades, the district has had a rule that requires landfills to be leak-free at the cap, and that we collect the gas out of the landfill and process it some way. Some of it goes waste to energy. Some of it is flared, which is actually a little more efficient, but doesn't generate the electricity. So just to be clear, we're refining some of that work and making sure that we're capturing what we should be capturing. But we have, for a long time, worked on that, even though methane is not within our smog rules.
Okay. Director Haggerty?
Thank you. And I'm sorry I arrived late. Some people should try commuting from my neck of the woods. It's very unpredictable. So in relationship to the methane, and when you're talking recycling and waste, in that category is the wastewater treatment plants? Yes.
Okay. Yes.
So, you know, I'm going to speak to one that's in my district that I spoke about the other day. Well, let me ask this other question first. I'm assuming that where you're monitoring the Livermore is more out by the landfills.
Are you talking about the research efforts that we're doing?
I thought that, this is about when I walked in, so I'm shooting from the hip, but I saw track long-term regional patterns of GHG concentrations, and I saw Livermore with a line and a dot, so I'm assuming that's a monitoring station?
Yes.
Okay, and where is that?
Director Haggerty, that's at the Air District's regular air monitoring station in Livermore. I don't know the address for you, but it's at our regular air monitoring station.
A lot of methane there.
And we added a GHG instrument at that station.
It's so not adjacent to the landfill.
It's what?
It's not adjacent to the landfill. So it's up for our regional monitoring.
That one is not intended to be a source-specific monitor, more of a sort of what's going on regionally monitor. So it's not if that one that monitor is not intended to specifically measure landfill generated methane.
Well, I'm more the reason I wanted to know is because I was hoping it wasn't just at the landfills. I was hoping I do remember we had a monitoring site in downtown Livermore at one time, the Air District. Now, is that the site we're talking about?
It's that site, although we did have to move it at one point. But it's still in the city of Livermore.
So if a wastewater treatment plant is constantly flaring, how far is it from a monitoring system before it's not detected? Do you understand that question?
If it's flaring, right, you're not going to detect methane for it. If that flare is operating correctly, it would be converting that methane to CO2, so you're not going to see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So therefore, the methane is gone and...
The CO2 would be what would be emitted from the combustion.
Okay. Do we have a problem with wastewater treatment plants that are constantly flaring?
It depends on...
I know in the petroleum industry... We all get up in arms, but for some reason, in the methane side of it, or maybe the government side of it, we don't care. Or maybe we care, but we're not zeroing in on it. So I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah,
I'm not the scientist here, so.
So there are various different methods that we use through our permitting to control emissions from these things. Obviously, some of the older facilities flares were the mechanism that we use there because of odors and because of other things. It helps to work in that area. Newer facilities, what we're seeing more of is reciprocating engines, turbines, things that convert that waste to energy. As the levels of waste that actually almost uniformly air district-wide, we're seeing folks come in from those communities, they want to use more and more of that waste. So we're seeing folks make a shift now to different types of technologies that capture that waste. So that those types of facilities are permitted, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, right? But we are seeing them shipped away from it basically because of some of the diversion that's happening and going to more enclosed systems that recover the energy.
How often do we inspect these facilities?
Wayne? Yeah, I'm right here.
So, hi.
Yeah, at least once a year. We do get a lot of complaints on landfills and so forth and associated plants, so we do go about inspecting those more often than normal. We also walk the landfill looking for leaks. The landfill is required to have a negative pressure on it. All that is supposed to be pulled into some sort of control system, which is either the flare or engines, and combusted so that the landfill doesn't leak. Sometimes those landfills will go positive pressure. That's what these leak detection on the wells are for, and our staff and their staff go out and do leak detection throughout over the whole landfill. Yeah. So we're looking for leaks on the landfill and making sure it's captured someplace and then combusted and or used for energy conversion. So that's how these things work. So flaring, your question about flaring, if they're flaring, they're actually capturing the gas and doing something with it at that point. You know, flaring's not actually what we want. We probably want some energy conversion, but some of these facilities don't have that ability.
Okay, so let me stop you there, because I do know that one of the landfills in my district is pretty responsible in relationship to capturing methane, but I have a couple. So, but I'm talking specifically, and let me be very clear, the wastewater treatment plant in Livermore smells to holy heaven.
It does.
Monday through Friday, 7 days a week, any time of the day. And I guess my question is, it doesn't seem like they're doing business right there. And do we get a lot of complaints there? Are we inspecting that facility? What are we doing with that facility?
Yeah. My understanding is we don't get a lot of complaints there. We don't get a lot of odor complaints there. Most of our odor complaints on those facilities tend to be in the Richmond area and or the south, Milpitas area, San Jose, your facility.
Well, that's from the Nubia.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's the sort of true. I'm trying to be specific to this facility that I can't even breathe when I drive by. I have to stop breathing.
There are odors coming off that facility. Yes. If we, I would encourage your constituents to call in complaints. We would go and take a look to see if they're doing everything right. You know, during different parts of the year, sewage treatment plants may smell differently just because they're harvesting sludge. They're doing something with the sludge. They do different operations there. So, you know, pressing water out of the sludge, that sort of thing. So if we can isolate what the odor is, that helps us. So if they can tell us time of day, if they can tell us when it's happening on an annual basis too, we can sort of hone in on what the actual problem is.
Like I said, it's 24/7, but I'll trust you that you're not getting many complaints. Yeah. I guess I'm totally amazed.
Yeah.
They call my office, but I'm going to tell them to start calling you.
Please.
Yeah. Okay.
And people do get accustomed to that smell. I know it's not a great answer, but they get accustomed to their normal odor in their area. People who drive through don't necessarily like it, but people who are living day to day, they tend to get acclimated to that smell. It's just a phenomenon that happens.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Director Sinks.
Thanks very much.
And then Director Ross.
So if I go to your slide 5, you talked about the top-down studies. Are these aerial studies that have been discussed at the Advisory Council? Is that what gave us much higher data? So they're flying around and actually seeing...
The studies are Fairley and Fisher in 2015. I'm sorry.
How technically are they conducted? It's not a van driving around the bay, right?
No,
This is an airplane or drones or
they're
something?
They're measurement towers that measure methane mixing ratios, or in other words, ambient concentration levels. And they use an inversion method to estimate methane from there.
Yeah, the Advisory Council scientists were talking about flying around and actually discovering things that we didn't know about.
Different studies.
This is different.
Those are different.
But Director Sinks, we have also had flights around various facilities, petrochemical facilities and landfills to help us improve the inventory. So it's been a combination of methods, but yes, those airplane flights.
Is that the Air District doing that, or is it researchers, or who's?
It's working with consultants and researchers.
So we're
the Air District has hired consultants to do this.
We have funded it, yes.
Oh, cool. Okay. And so if I look at this comparison on landfills, the model versus the measurement, first of all, the pie chart that we saw on the prior slide, is that composed of the model or the measurement data?
So the basically the inventory is using the standard methods, which is essentially taking most of the time is taking emission factors and quantities like throughputs for the known sources.
So that's so model.
That's correct.
That's the calculation for the. Okay. Oh, go ahead. For this, the inventory.
This is the uncorrected information. In this pie chart, we very much expect that these the number, the mass, the total number would be greater, and the distribution may also change a little bit. Certainly,
yeah,
landfills
just looking
would be
at
the largest.
I mean, landfills nearly double, right, from the model to the measured. And correct. So now you have to try to reconcile those things over time to see if you can improve the model to match.
Yeah, but looking at the relative proportion, it may not be quite as big as you think because most of the rest of them increase also.
Oh, so, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so the overall mass may increase, but it may shift to 60 right. or 65%. But still, we understand that it's the biggest source that we have.
So the sleuthing is to, in no small measure, try to go figure out what's composting versus solid waste versus the traditional landfill.
Correct.
And then see how we might... I know... Landfills are traditionally either just covered with dirt or vaulted by some means, right? And then
correct.
You try to extract the methane and other gases that come from it and,
correct.
As you said, flare it off or whatever. But if our biggest problem is composting, I mean, many people where I live and I imagine all over the Bay Area now are filling up their, you know, organic waste cans with vegetation and other things, and what they're actually sending to the landfill per se is really tiny, right? You can fit it in a little bag most weeks.
Still though,
the opportunity really may be in processing what's in my area called the brown can.
Yeah, both I think you know they're both areas where I think some state policies may help us as well. You know, the renewable fuel standard has contemplated that some of these will actually start to get converted to fuel. So that's where we're hoping that facilities may take the initiative on themselves. There may be an economic factor that will help them, along with our regulations, to start moving in the direction that we want them. Converting a lot of these waste to fuel and not letting them go into the atmosphere would be, and then displacing petroleum. That's kind of... Where?
So an example of that, for example, would be the new waste management facility that Marin Clean Energy is taking advantage of.
And I think are they converting to hydrogen there, or they're converting to natural gas for the trucks? I think there's a couple of different. There are a number
I think
of these
projects.
They're
energy
they're
to
creating
the grid.
Electricity.
Energy to grid. Okay.
Yeah.
There are a number of different projects in Marin that are doing a couple of different things. So.
Yeah, Katie was showing me this before we.
Yeah.
We got in here. So that seems really interesting. And so, I mean, in order to regulate this properly, we really do need to understand, yeah, what is coming from that solid waste treatment? What processes are we using for that today? If we're just drying stuff out in the sun, as I think we do in the South Bay, maybe it's time we considered an upgrade, I guess, right? And okay. You talked about anaerobic digestion facilities, and the only one I know of is ZWED in the South Bay. I'm sure there are others. Supposedly, right, it's all enclosed. They're capturing the methane. They're burning it to create power for their facility. Is the process deficient? Are they not actually converting all the organics to methane? Is it only partially digested, or... How does it contribute?
So that's why it's under knowledge gaps, Director Sink. We're okay. trying to figure that out. I mean, it's all part of the broader system of the green waste management. And so it's on our agenda for further study right now. It's not something we consider a particularly high priority for the reasons you brought up. It's something we can't really ignore because mm-hmm. even a properly maintained facility or a properly designed facility is going to have leaks or operational variations that so we may need to step in with some regulation in that area.
Well, it's probably capturing the vast majority.
Absolutely. Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely. But, you know, the landfills are capturing the vast majority as well, and yet they're still pretty high emitters. Yeah.
Well, so I've been down to the Recology facility in the hills above Gilroy and seen these big windrows, and how they're stirred up and right, they get to a temperature. But, you know, when I've asked, okay, would it be expensive to cover this to try to capture the methane? The answer is, oh, yeah. So, but maybe that's actually the biggest opportunity. If we understood how big that was, maybe we'd be working on that.
Best practices in composting have been evolving over the past couple of years. Some of those windrows facilities are moving now to another design where they have a layer of a biofilter on top. And so it's not enclosing the facility, but it's a modern design that we think is a step up from the windrows. And that's what they've installed in Richmond and are operating.
What do you cover it with?
They cover it with a more kind of partly cured compost, so it provides a bit of biofilter, and of course it's readily available at the composting facility.
Cool.
So it's a pretty good solution when they do it right, but the problem is the facilities may not be designed to handle the volume that they're now having to process.
Yeah. So my final question for now is, you know, if we look at greenhouse gas emissions overall, and I know it's sort of apples and oranges, you have the short-term methane versus the longer-term CO2, but what's the standard metric for the impact of methane versus carbon? What fraction of greenhouse gas emissions do we consider methane to be versus CO2 and contributing to the climate problem?
And I look to Henry on that. I think it was...
The uncorrected estimates that were shown on that pie chart are total emissions, I believe, total CO2 equivalent are about 89 to 90 million tons. And so this chart we showed you were 4 million tons. We think that's going to go higher based on some of this research. So what would that be in the 5 to 10% range?
Yeah, 5 to 10%.
Exactly.
And other than that, the state thinks cap and trade is going to handle the bulk of it, at least for those cap and trade facilities, right? So,
yeah. Not on.
I might spin it more like Adania did, which is we get a lot of co-benefits in terms of toxic emission and odor reduction. And I also think it suits our particular strengths very well. Because we've got the field staff, we understand how to find and fix leaks. We've got a lot of experience in dealing with these kinds of pollutants.
Okay, thank you.
Director Ross?
Well, thank you, Chair Barrett. I am going to follow up on Director Singh's lead in there on the, I'm wondering if there's a metric, and I know it'd be complex and it might be apples to oranges, what percentage of the methane inventory is it in the overall airshed in the Bay Area, and what's the efficacy of this control method, in associating with the climate forcing of the particular emission? I mean, is there some type of a score, like, or metric, or measuring idea where, well, it's 5% of the airshed, but it's 24 times or 32 times more climate forcing than other emissions? How efficacious is it per ton to remove? And I know each type of mitigation measure would be more effective or less effective. Do you get what I'm saying? Some type of, well, this is only this, but it's more effective for us to spend maybe double per ton on that or triple per ton on that than it would be over here. Is there some type of overall grand unified metric?
One frame of reference is when you look at it at a 100-year basis, which is all the numbers have provided, it is about 4% of our inventory. But then when you look at it on a 20% basis, then it jumps to around 10%, and that's before adjustment. I'm sorry, 20-year basis. 20-year basis, it jumps to around 10% of the pie, and that's without adjusting for the new research.
Yeah. And assuming that it's 34 times more climate forcing than it seems in that particular period of time, that would be where the effort could be concentrated to have a larger effect than on CO2. And that's kind of the premise that you see us bringing forward here.
Yeah, I understand all these numbers are fungible and the tails on all the modeling can go any which way. I'm just wondering if we've ever take a step back and look, said, you know, if we spend $1 million of effort, $1 million of the public's money, or $2 million of the public's money on this effort plus staff time versus this, which benefit, which is the greater benefit? And is there a market difference? And is there a shorter term difference for a short term effect and a longer term effect? And do we ever look at it and our efforts in that way? Or is that just too complicated, too many variables?
I'll start. Director Ross and Jean may add to my comments. It's a great question. I don't think we have a one single metric to sort of get to the point that you're making because, well, for a variety of reasons. But really, if you remember the long-term climate stabilization goals that we outlined in our clean air plan and that the state has outlined, it's an all-in strategy. I mean, we need GHG reductions from all sectors to reach those targets. But as Adania said, we think there are really there, it makes a lot of sense to focus on methane in the near term because it is such a powerful climate forcer. And there are sort of near-term benefits that can be achieved. Some of the strategies to reduce CO2 involve more significant changes to our economy and our lifestyle, and we think it just makes a lot. We need ultimately to do both. But we think there's some real near-term opportunities by addressing methane now.
And just thank you. The last part of this would be, are there any other climate-forcing emissions of any notable tonnage in our airshed that are 50 or climate-forcing factors of 50, 100, 200? That might be targets as well.
Yes, there's some of the F-gases are thousands of times more powerful than carbon dioxide. And we have strategies to address those as well. That's, for instance, gases used in refrigerants, semiconductor manufacturing, they're very powerful climate forcers.
Are they a significant tonnage in the Bay Area? Or are they in the hundreds of thousands?
No, they're very small tonnages, but because they are so powerful, their effect is become significant.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still in the overall, if we had a pie chart of the emissions, CO2 and methane are by far the most significant greenhouse gases in the region on a CO2 equivalent basis.
I guess the root of my question would be on a pie chart with all of our, we have limited resources. No matter, we could cover every emission that there is, but we have limited resources here. So I'm just wondering if there's ever a pie chart that shows, well, if you spend X number of effort on this emission, you're going to get a greater benefit than that emission. I'm just wondering if that's ever been looked at.
I think, as Henry said, we need to do the best things we can do as quickly as possible, the best things that are in our wheelhouse. And we have not boiled it down to one metric, no.
Well, it would be a rough metric.
We might think about that.
I don't know. I really don't know how you could fine-tune it, but thank you.
Yeah. And can I add something really quickly? There's also nitrous oxide, which is frequently co-emitted with methane. So that's an added benefit when you're tackling methane. For some sources, you also tackle nitrous oxide, which is roughly 400 times more powerful than CO2.
Thank you.
Then we better crack down at Grateful Dead shows.
Yeah. Good morning. Question to clarify for me. So on the pie chart on slide 4, that slice of recycling and waste and or specifically around the landfill methane emissions, it does not include then that methane that is captured and flared off as CO2?
I wouldn't believe so. I don't believe so, but Henry can.
So whatever advances we've made in terms of capturing the methane and flaring off is not part of that 88%.
That's correct. Those emissions would be reflected in carbon dioxide emissions from landfills in a different inventory. So those would be reported elsewhere. Yes.
Right. And yet still landfills are our greatest emitters. So that means that we're not capturing a lot of the methane.
That means that we have more work to do to understand how the methane is being emitted there. Once the cap is on, then it's easy to capture the gas. But what happens when the waste is lying there waiting to go into the landfill? What's happening when composting is happening? All of those are still emitting. It's the same thing with POTWs. Just because they're enclosed, that doesn't mean that the life cycle of that particular facility all of the emissions are captured in it. So this is the work we need to do to understand where the rest of this methane is coming from. Some of it is coming from fugitive leaks that we may not be seeing. Some of it is coming from the staging preparation of that waste to go into the landfill. And then some of it is happening like post-collection system, because eventually these collection systems do shut off, right? But that doesn't mean that the landfill is, that all of that activities has ceased in the landfill. We just may not be seeing it.
And so from landfill to landfill, depending on how well they were built, for less, lack of a better word, or improved, and or their flaring technology, they're probably have different ratios of how much they're actually capturing and flaring or doing whatever with.
Correct.
Or emitting. So, and I was going to bring up the Redwood landfill that yesterday they did the ribbon cutting on a five plus megawatt, gas
cogeneration
facility. Cost $14 million for them to put that in place. I don't know how long it took, and I'm going to be curious to understand what the regulatory role we played in that and how easy or not easy the permitting was around it. But it seems to me that it's such a win-win-win to change that flaring, the flaring of the CO2 into energy. It means, and actually I think it'd be a win for the landfill as well, because they've got a contract down with MCE to sell that energy, which must have, you know, it's going to pay off dividends. That one landfill or that one small $14 million facility is supplying energy 24 hours a day now for 5,000 homes. Mm-hmm. So it seems like there's a ton of opportunity within the Bay Area to take advantage of what is already being captured, which is sounds like may only be a slice of the methane capture, and in terms of actually turning what is now being emitted as CO2 into energy. And then, frankly, I'm just wondering if you aren't looking at landfills and prioritizing actually helping these landfills through either regulatory measures or incentives, the ones that are behind advance more quickly. Mm-hmm. I know we want to understand exactly what the inventories are, but we also know that we can do a lot with technology we already have in terms of nipping stuff in the bud. Anyway, that's sort of general comment. And then I had a question about our ag waste and our dairies, and in the North Bay, certainly they're all small. I don't even know if there's any medium, even in Sonoma. I would characterize them all as fairly small operations. And there's a lot of concern on the part of those operators about the costs to do the kind of biodigesters, whatever, that are necessary. I don't think there's any disagreement that they are going to be really helpful for those businesses to manage their methane releases, but you know, $300,000-$400,000 is a lot to a small operation. So I just think we have to be really mindful of how our regulations impact that sector of our economy, local economies. And not that because the technology's there, we know it, but we can't put people out of business. And frankly, if they stop being dairies, they're going to just start having free roaming cows, which, you know, got cow pies all over the hillside as opposed to in the loafing barns. So shows how much I know, right? Those are my only comments. But if you want to speak to the dairy piece, it's a real concern.
I would like to speak to the dairy piece, because obviously there's going to be a lot of concern about that given the statewide efforts on trying to control emissions from dairies. We have run the numbers, and our determination is that it's not cost effective for any dairies in the Bay Area to install these kind of control devices. So that wouldn't be something we would do as a regulatory effort. It would be more in the lines of an incentives effort or something like that.
Have you communicated that to the dairy industry?
Not yet, but sounds like we should.
I might get out there ahead of you. I'd love to see it.
I think if you look at our permitting and thresholds, we're talking about facilities that are 10,000.
10,000 head?
Yeah, so the thresholds are quite high. I think we had this a couple of years ago when we were setting those thresholds, but more communication on this may be necessary in light of what's happened at the state. One thing I would say is, though, we have seen kind of some lower cost technology move into this area. We're seeing some small projects in the Central Valley that are, you know, not very complicated. And some of the things that we've been talking about are some of the, we're looking at financing mechanisms that may already exist actually at the state level that folks may not be aware of, that we're going to try and put a spotlight on through our technology implementation office.
Right. And I would, and one of the, there is an incentive also on the part of a lot of these dairies to actually use that energy, utilize it themselves so it can pay off, because most of them aren't on the grid anyway. But I think there's interest there, but there was a lot of fear around the cost. So glad to hear we're going in that direction.
And you know, we're having a conversation with the Technology Implementation Office tomorrow, actually, about methane. And so sounds like it'd be good to work through them to kind of reach out to the dairies and give them a feel for what our strategy is for dealing with their waste.
Thank you. That's interesting to know. So 10,000 head is kind of the break even level at this point. We have nothing in 10,000 head in Napa. We talked about odor, and I drive by different odors all the time. Is odor always pollution, and is all odor the same value?
Odor is not all the same.
Yeah. Odor is in the eye of the beholder.
And sometimes,
or in the nose of the beholder, excuse me.
And sometimes there are odors that are more than a quality of life issue, and sometimes there are quality of life issue, and none of it's, you know, if it's disturbing people's lives, it's not a good thing.
But is that something that we can do something about?
Why don't we have Wayne weigh in on this? One example I would give you is, you know, if you live near a coffee roaster, right, if you love the smell of coffee, it's great. If you don't, and we've had these issues, it can be. So, Wayne, do you want to?
Yeah, but there's no pollution in that. Or there is?
There could be. Yeah,
there is,
and there could be. What we do is when we get odor complaints where there's some odors present, we look for violations of our rules, state rules, federal rules, for standards. You know, if it's H2S, there's standards for that. A lot of cases, it's below the detection level for any, or even below the standard for any particular constituent that we can regulate. But then we do have the ability to issue public nuisance on odors, you know, that it bothers somebody or a group of people. And so that's where we would get to odors, too. So there's sort of a twofold. If it doesn't violate any standard that we have, if it annoys a considerable number of people, according to the Health and Safety Code, we could do a public nuisance. And that's about all we can do. Not all odors violate any regulatory standard.
Thank you.
Director Agakoka.
So I was hoping to better understand landfills. We have one in our community, and we actually have flare stations and microturbines. So is it that despite what we have, we're still not capturing everything? Okay. And then in terms of flare stations versus microturbines, like, should we be converting everything to cogeneration, or... I don't know why we did both, and I'm sure there's, you know, history, but is that what we should be looking at down the road?
I think that there's clearly a lot of interest in landfills and related waste stream. We've talked with the station resource about it in some ways over time, and I think that we'll need to bring back this one back multiple times, maybe through different committees, to look at different parts of this equation, because we've regulated in this area for landfills and POTWs for a very long time.
Right.
Composting is a little more of a challenge for us, but the state's certainly involved, as Director Joya said, and we're focusing on methane, which we hadn't particularly focused on in the past. And so we will work with the chairs of the committees and the chair of the board and talk to Jack and figure out where we can bring these kinds of discussions forward. Because there are a lot of questions, there's a lot of new information, and I think it would be helpful for all of us to talk about this more and figure out the best path forward.
Great. So. And then, so we are our wastewater treatment plant that we share with a couple of our neighbors, or we've been talking about it for a few years now, but it's that time once in every 50 years where we have to rebuild it. So we're starting to plan, you know, to put some money away. But I guess timeline-wise, in terms of what you're doing, is there a sense of when you'll come up with some, you know, mandates, recommendations? And then the other part of it is very costly, as we all know. And I see that there's advocacy for funding here, but what kinds of potential funding sources are there for these new improvements?
You deal with the regulation, I'll talk about funding.
All right. So the timeline and the regulations for POTWs, I wouldn't expect to see us digging into that seriously before 2019. We are working with the industrial organization, name escapes me now. We meet with them like once a month, every other month, talking about various issues in permitting and in rural development. And we work closely with them to keep up on best practices, and those kind of best practices can be incorporated into permitting requirements for the particular example that you're giving. And I'll defer to Damien on incentive questions.
So we're very lucky to have Michael Montgomery. Michael's here with us on loan from EPA. He's working with our Technology Implementation Office, and Michael actually comes from the wastewater world. And what we found is, as we're looking at this, there is a lot of funding out there, and people may not be aware that it's there. So some of the work that we'll be doing through the TIO, and Michael is doing it over the next couple of months for us, is to figure out what those funding sources are and to do some matchmaking. So that's some work that we're getting started. We're going to be presenting to the executive committee some of our preliminary results to get some feedback from them, and then hopefully we can figure out how to make folks aware of it. As Greg said, you know, we do meet with these folks on a regular basis. One of the concerns they have is compliance with our upcoming regulation 1118. The good thing about those facilities is that they have a built-in ratepayer base, so that they have the ability to make these changes, I think, but it's just a question of timing. Mm-hmm. So as we kind of go forward and look at the regulation, like we do with all of our incentive programs, we want there to be a little bit of push-pull there, but we will definitely work with the facilities to make sure that they are considering and that they are aware of the funding sources and other things that are out there.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, now I'm going to go to the public. Is there any public comment?
I have Jed Holtzman and Janet Stromberg.
Okay.
Crazy. Not a specific threat, just general.
Thank you, Chair Barrett and directors. Jed Holtzman, 350 Bay Area. I want to thank staff for all of their work. Certainly support all of these efforts, as we did in our comments on the Clean Air Plan, but am concerned, as you might be surprised to hear. Essentially, if we're cutting out the ability to reduce GHGs from carbon dioxide in our Clean Air Plan and our Regional Climate Protection Strategy, which is what we're hearing AB 398 will mean for us, even by the plain language, which I agree with, the methane strategy and all of the rules that are embedded within it in the Clean Air Plan need to be even more aggressive and more stringent in order to compensate for the shortfall that we're going to have in the reductions that the Clean Air Plan calls for, lays out, and that are clearly necessary. As a corollary, I think this committee and really the full board needs to see what staff believes AB 398 does to your Clean Air Plan and your Regional Climate Protection Strategy, your control strategy, your rural development plans, and your schedule. We need to see what we think that inhibition of our action does to our ability to meet Figure 3.9 in your Clean Air Plan, that very steep downward GHG curve that I am always harping on. There are many rules, even just in the 2017 and 2018, or some rules, I should say, in the 2017 and 2018 section of your Clean Air Plan, which is the promise that you made to the region, a vision that you promoted and did PR on and sold to two media sources, that are CO2 rules. And so we are not necessarily going to be able to move forward with those. This is not just Rule 1216, which was put into your plan by surprise, but you're also pulling back preliminarily on integrating CO2 into the permit plan, which we think in an effective way, which we think you can still go ahead and do even under AB 398. To the discussion that you've had, the robust discussion on landfills, even just within the basin-wide methane strategy, landfill control measure WA1 was listed for 2018 in the Clean Air Plan, and now is not on the timeline. There might be some confusion about just what's included under composting versus landfills, but again, given that it is by far the largest source in both your inventory and your direct measurements, I think we definitely need to see anything that we can do there. In short, the regional climate protection strategy would leave us far short of our climate goals, and if it is now gutted, then we need to see where we're at and how we can compensate for that. Thank you.
Good morning. Janet Stromberg again. First, I want to appreciate the invitation I received from staff to participate in the stakeholder strategy development group. I look forward to providing some help with that effort. Back on the issue of the permit rule, if methane were included as one of the pollutants that is looked at in the permit rule, it would be an opportunity to address in real time very quickly proposed new sources and modifications. Your permit rule is the fastest device that you have in your regulatory arsenal to look at permits and see what the state of the art is in real time. And so you can be advancing the process out there with projects that are going on as we're speaking, as we're doing research, as we're doing other rule development. You really need to leverage that program, and I hope that you will add methane to it. If we look back at slide number 11, I was really happy to see that in addition to thinking about direct methane emissions and control strategies for those, there was mention of fuel switching from natural gas to electricity for buildings, which I presume is for both the residential and commercial sector or any other kind of building. And I think that was an important addition to this. I think there needs to be another circle, though. If you look at the proportion of emissions of methane from industrial was 14%, and I think commercial and residential was 4%. So we really should add stationary sources if we're going to be starting to look at fuel switching in order to address downstream, the upstream methane emissions are coming from the demand downstream to burn natural gas. And so the fuel switching efforts that you can make for industry as well as buildings could be very important. And one very easy one would be to start looking at where there are emission controls that require oxidation, where we have afterburners that could be used by catalytic oxidation. And so there are opportunities in industry to reduce, to do the fuel switching now. That's an easy one, and there are probably some other ones. Thanks.
No more closed session. Well, I would just like to bring it back to the board if anyone has any closing statement to make about this. But one thing that my takeaway on this is about the landfills. Unlike Director Sinks, I'm not so optimistic about how we are meeting the 75% of diversion from the landfills. I know we're not in our area, even though our carrier was contractually obligated to meet it. And so far we haven't, you know, we're not on the path to get there. And I don't know how many other areas are in that situation. And we also found that what they were doing wasn't really meeting the intent of our contract with them, and certainly not the goal of 75% diversion by 2020. So I think that in looking at addressing the methane issue, you have to take into consideration the fact that the composting needs will also be expanding as well as the level of control needs to be higher. So I think that that's really important, especially given the nuisance factor that's associated with those. Any other members? Okay, Mr. Sinks.
Yeah, I wanted to get some clarification. I know when I've been down to Newby Island in the South Bay that it's been said we don't have authority over the composting facility and its emissions. Can you help me for these major things? So I guess I would include that, the natural gas distribution system. Do we regulate how much methane is generated, or is that the CPUC? For composting, for solid waste management. I mean, we all have influence as elected officials, you know, because our cities need solid waste treatment and right, we need to get rid of composting. But I'm trying to understand how much this organization, this agency, is able to directly influence.
I'm not sure I caught all the source categories, but we regulate solid waste landfills and have for a long, long time. We talked a little bit about that. There's actually a range of requirements for daily cover on the working face and ultimately the closed cap, gas capture
and treatment. And these are our requirements.
Those are our requirements. Those are our regulations. And as a matter of fact, the larger of the landfills closed at a certain point in time also fall under the federal Title V program. So there's a very vigorous landfill regulation. At one point in the past, this district was very aggressive about odors from composting operations, which generated a state law that prohibited us from regulating odors from composting operations.
Oh, deja vu.
So, it sort of seems to work that way. But we have done a lot of work in that area.
What about the natural gas distribution system?
The distribution system itself is regulated at the federal level by a branch of the DOT, which is the Pipeline Safety Administration. That's true for hazardous material pipelines of all types. There are elements of it, and we talked a little bit about them, the production side of it, that we have some regulatory authority over, and we've been exercising that. We're expanding that. But the pipeline
itself, this 87% of 14%, that seems to be a large thing. I guess it's probably all over the Bay Area, but do we have any direct regulatory authority to require that the, you know, leaks in distribution of natural gas get fixed?
That's not clear.
Could be, maybe not.
Probably not.
Well, but we might have something to say about it.
Well, after it gets out of the pipeline, it's used at facilities that do have some leaks, and we do regulate those parts of the operation. So maybe not the pipeline itself, but at the point of use, managing the leaks there is certainly a big deal. And that actually is a significant part of that.
And it's a life safety
issue. We think it's larger
too,
than, right? We think that that's larger than we have understood historically, and that's part of the reason why there's more methane in the air than we had understood.
And finally, I know AB 389 has something to say about cap and trade sources.
398,
thank you. But there are certainly sources of CO2 that aren't automobiles or trucks. And art cap and trade sources. Do we have any thoughts about what's left and what we could regulate there?
The bulk of the CO2 emitted from industrial sources in the region is sources under the cap, but there's still some sources of CO2 that are not under the cap. I don't have the exact percentages with me right now.
Okay. Well, I'd appreciate any follow-up on, you know, we think that that might be fruitful. Thank you.
Gene, I would just sort of having listened to the public speakers, I do think at a future date, both for this committee and maybe probably for the broader board, it would be good to understand the implications impact of 398 on our clean air plan more broadly. And then secondarily, I think when it would be helpful to me and hopefully my colleagues here would agree that as we discuss future rules and regs and sort of work plan for the district, how those items align with or not or fit into the blueprint that was laid out in our clean air plan. Oh, and one more thing. I am not, I don't feel well enough versed in this, but on the new source review amendments that have been referenced, I would like to understand understand better the whys or why nots of how methane fits or doesn't fit in with the new source review. And that can be offline education as well.
Well, I can give you a very quick answer on that, and also because this issue has now come up a couple of times. The NSR program regulation 2 amendments that you will be seeing in, I believe, early December address some program deficiencies identified by EPA that we need to fix in order to move that program forward and get approval, because we have a sanctions clock running. That doesn't preclude us doing additional work in that program over time. So that's point one. Point two is, if we are regulating methane because rules require, or, you know, as we change out of the exemptions for methane that are somewhat built in, those become part of NSR automatically. NSR doesn't have a list of pollutants we look at. It looks at what we regulate in our program. And so if methane is regulated in our program, methane becomes part of the NSR formula. So that happens just as a matter of course in how the NSR program is applied. If the rules require methane controls, then they're applied through the NSR program on that side of it. So just to put, I mean, Janet is correct. It's an elegant program, and it's flexible, and that is one of the ways that it is flexible, is as pollutants become regulated, they become part of that package.
Yes.
If I could add on to Director Rice's comment about, you know, coming up with what we can't do with 398, but what we might look at is the co-benefit alternative path, what we can do that parallels those efforts, which I'm sure that you know, is not the spirit of the law, but I'm sure there's other ways we can skin a cat cracker, if you will. So if we could look at those alternative strategies as well when we're considering what we can't do, but maybe what we can do to augment and support the legislation. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no one else wanting to speak on this, thank you for your presentation and all the information. And we'll move on to item 4, Climate Protection Grant Program.
Great. Chair Barrett, members of the committee, before I introduce this item, I just want to call attention to something that's at your place. You'll see this blue document, the Bay Area Solar Voltaic Ordinance Toolkit. So at your last meeting, you may recall that staff reported to you on work we've been doing on this model ordinance. We've just recently completed this, and the very short summary is that it's sort of a complete toolkit that we are providing to city and county staff to help them develop local ordinances that would require solar photovoltaic panels on new construction. And so this has been underway quite a while, along with staff at the Bay Area Regional Collaborative. And we've just launched this. We reported this to the BARC board last week here in this room. We're having a webinar tomorrow. It's on our website. So this has been underway for quite a while, and the committee members have expressed interest. So I just wanted to make sure that you were aware that it's available. And we have a copy there for you, and we'd be happy to follow up with your staff if you're interested.
Can you send us all an electronic version of this?
Certainly, yes.
And assume, is it posted on our website?
Yes, it is.
Good. Or yes. Send us the link, or send us an electronic version.
Certainly, we'll do. So with that, Chair Barrett, within the Clean Air Plan and the budget that the board adopted earlier this year, we proposed a climate protection grant program to help us implement some of the programs in the Clean Air Plan. And Abby Young, our climate protection manager, will update you on the progress to date.
Thank you, Henry. And thank you, Chair Barrett and committee members. This is one of the many non-regulatory measures that we are developing and implementing as part of our Clean Air Plan. So the purpose of my presentation this morning is to share with you staff's current thinking on this $4.5 million grant program. We've been meeting with stakeholders. We've been thinking a lot about what we want to do. And this is a great point early in the process to get your feedback and your input. So we're very eager to hear your thoughts. The Air District has a good history of funding activities to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Since 2011, we've invested about $60 million in getting electric vehicles and EV charging infrastructure throughout the Bay Area. We're investing, I think, about $23 million in 2018 coming up on trip reduction and clean vehicles. In the last 5 or 6 years, we've invested over $150 million in reducing diesel and black carbon emissions from heavy-duty vehicles and wood smoke. So our traditional programs that the Strategic Incentives Division implements has really been helping with reducing greenhouse gases in the Bay Area. Now, specifically targeting greenhouse gases, in 2009, through a settlement with ConocoPhillips, we had a little bit over $4 million that we invested in grants to fund energy efficiency and renewable energy technologies on public buildings in the communities around the refinery. And even before that, about 10 years ago, we had a formal climate protection grant program, and I see several members of the committee here today that were part of the board back then when we implemented that program. And that is what I want to speak a little bit more about. So in 2007, we had $3 million, and we awarded that through 53 different grants to local governments and nonprofits throughout the Bay Area. And those were pretty small, or fairly small grants, $24,000 to $75,000. And we spread that money fairly broadly across a number of different themes. We funded some school-based activities, climate action planning, some capacity building, and I'll explain that in just a minute. We wanted to look at best practices that already existed and try to get them replicated. And we focused a large number of that investment on innovative new strategies. We feel that this was a very successful grant program. We, particularly in the area of fostering innovation, a couple big game-changing initiatives came out of that original funding. We funded some of the startup for Marin Clean Energy, which is, I think you all know, was the first community choice energy program, which by the end of next year, nearly all communities in the Bay Area will be covered by some kind of community choice energy program. We also funded the Berkeley First program, which grew into and became the first property assessed clean energy, or PACE, financing program, a model that has taken off and spread across the country that allows people to finance energy efficiency and renewable energy through their property taxes. I mentioned capacity building grants, and what those were was a response to a common theme that we hear, that there simply isn't a lot of staffing resources in local governments to do the climate protection and energy work. So what we did was we made 7 grants to seed fund what we hoped would end up being permanent staff positions that would address energy efficiency and climate protection work in different communities. And now remember, we made these grants in 2007, right before a big recession. And I can proudly say that 6 of those 7 positions survived that recession and are still thriving today. So that we feel that was a good model. And then we funded 19 different climate action plans, which really kick-started a critical mass of climate action plans being developed in the Bay Area. And today, we have the most local climate action plans of any metropolitan area in the United States. So we feel that was a very successful program, and we want to learn from what we did in that program in 2007 and try to take some of the best of that and use it in this program we're developing now. So again, these goals and objectives reflect staff's thinking, and we want to hear your feedback. Certainly, the overarching goal for this program is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and we want to do that by accelerating the implementation of our Clean Air Plan. So we have a number of objectives to support that goal. We want to invest in greenhouse gas reduction activities that also result in some co-benefits of reducing other pollutants in other pollutant categories. We want to not just accelerate the implementation of our Clean Air Plan, but also the implementation of local climate action plans. We want to engage impacted communities and make sure that they benefit from these grants so that these investments may not only reduce emissions in those communities, but may also bring other quality of life benefits, such as workforce development or job creation. We want to identify and fill funding gaps. We want to make sure that our funding is really making a difference. We want to certainly fund activities that are replicable and scalable. And we want to make sure that we complement other air district grant and incentive programs. So certainly the programs in our strategic incentives division, but also the activities of our technology implementation office and the efforts of our community engagement programs. So we have $4.5 million in our current budget, and we've been thinking about how to give this money out. As I mentioned, in 2007, we issued 53 grants ranging from $24,000 to $75,000. We are thinking this time and suggesting that we do fewer, larger grants. And we're thinking of framing this in terms of a range of potential grant sizes and total grant amounts. So, for example, we may articulate in our call for projects that we anticipate awarding, and I'm making this up for illustrative purposes, but that we anticipate awarding 15 to 30 grants in the range of $100,000 to $300,000. Providing it in that kind of context allows us the flexibility to respond to whatever kinds of applications we receive. So we're trying to build in a flexible design. And then in thinking about who we want to give these grants to, this time we're suggesting that we focus these grants on local governments. So towns, cities, counties, school districts, special districts. And the reason we're thinking this is that we feel that local governments can best determine how to work with community organizations to implement their own local climate action plans. So that's what we're thinking. But we can certainly, through our guidelines, encourage collaborations with local nonprofits and even across local governments. So what should we fund? We've been thinking and asking ourselves, do we want to go broad or do we want to go deep? And we thought, well, maybe we can try to do both. So in our outreach to local governments and other stakeholder groups, funders and community groups, we were asking, you know, what area of a local climate action plan are you having the most difficulty addressing, and where could air district funding really help you? And the most common response we got was getting natural gas out of existing buildings. So, and that was a very common response. So we thought, well, that makes a lot of sense. It's an area that's difficult to address. There is not a lot of funding for it. And yet it's a huge emissions source and one in which we have to make tremendous reductions in order to get where we want to be in 2030 and 2050. So we're thinking that we would like to focus some of this funding on existing buildings. So that's the deep part. Now, back in 2007, we kind of gambled on a broad call for innovation, and we feel like it really paid off. We don't want to exclude the next great idea by solely focusing in one area. So if we complement this deep call to address energy in existing buildings, with a more broad call for innovation that allows for applications that may come to address, with innovative strategies, a variety of different emission sources. So this is what we're proposing, and we're very interested to hear your thoughts. Now, as I mentioned, we've been meeting with many local governments, and we're continuing. There's some we haven't reached yet, so we're continuing those meetings. We conducted a survey back in the spring on to local governments on what kinds of resources and funding they might need. We've met with some community-based organizations. We've had discussions with other climate funders to try to make sure we're not duplicating anything. And we're, again, really trying to coordinate with the other funding mechanisms we have here within the AIR district. So what you'll see coming up, well, first of all, we want to get your input, and we're excited to be able to get it at an early stage in this process. So we want to take your input and use it as we develop the actual guidelines, and then we will come back to you at your next meeting in November and present draft guidelines to you. And those would include, you know, a more fleshed out description of the funding categories, scoring criteria, things like that. We'll get your input and then come back, or we'll issue the call for projects with the formal guidelines in December. We'll spend January and February with that call open. So we'll be receiving, probably having, you know, workshops and receiving applications and do the scoring. And then we anticipate, or we're aiming to bring, to present the awards to the board for approval in March. So that's what I have, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Abby, I appreciate your presentation very much. It's exciting to talk about this. I think as this AIR district helped create community choice energy in the state, and all of our all the counties are now in or going in, most all the cities, we are beginning to accumulate our own funds for programs. So we're putting money away into reserves to try to make sure we can do some rate stabilization. But we're accumulating money for programs. But frankly, we have not a, we don't have, I don't want to say we don't have a clue. but honestly, we don't have a clue about how to spend that money well. Okay, and I think this AIR district and its expert staff could have great influence, not only on the dollars that we have to spend, but on how the money that all these community choice energy agencies have to spend. So we had I'll just tell this, Margaret knows this, she's on our board as well. We were befuddled in August with discussion and weren't really satisfied what our staff had come up with, but there weren't any real metrics. There were no scoring systems. So we're like, we want to do something. Can we fuel switch? How far from our narrow domain of electricity production and sale do we want to go, right? But I think what I'd ask you to really think about is how could you help us critically think about scoring programs, rating programs, and which have the most efficacy. You know, it's awful easy to have a pot of money and not spend it efficiently, and it's not what our ratepayers expect, nor, you know, any of us managing public agencies. So, and for my part, I like the idea of fuel switching natural gas out of buildings. I would say, you know, we know that in the transportation sector, our frustration in not having no direct control over mobile sources regulation, nor now major facilities with CO2 and trying to get those reductions. I think we ought to continue to really work on transportation. And yeah, we are, and the Mobile Source Committee talks about that. But for my cup of tea, getting more of these old diesel trucks off the road that I mean, this is my third morning at the AIR district this week, and I'm sitting behind some of these trucks that, you know, I can tell that what I'm breathing is not healthy, And I think we ought to have continued major focus on converting from old diesel to alternatives that are clean. Thanks.
Go ahead.
Thanks for the presentation. Just a few thoughts. I think, the priority is always trying to get achievable GHG reductions that also have co-benefits. It seems that that's the priority, that we want the greatest amount of GHG reductions along with the co-benefits. And that we also have some amount or some focus on some of our care and disadvantaged communities. That's what's happening as we look at expenditure of cap and trade funds, a certain percent going there. And of course, we can use our definition of care communities, which is more expansive than the state's disadvantaged community definition. So it includes more communities throughout the Bay Area. And you talk about engaged, impacted communities. I do think that's really important. There's more and more frustration that many impacted communities feel they have not been, you know, the recipient of some funds. So I think, again, so focusing on some care communities around the Bay Area with projects that have the greatest GHG reduction with co-benefits. I do think we have to think about how we help jurisdictions apply, because what happens often in this kind of funding is the cities or districts or that are most capable of applying will, and the ones that
already have.
That's right, exactly. Mm-hmm. So we need to be helpful to provide them technical support or whatever they need, so that communities who haven't applied in the past can. Otherwise, the gap grows between the cities that are more able to and those that are not. Mm-hmm. You know, on this issue of mobile and stationary, which I think is interesting that Rod raised. I mean, there are not a lot of new regulations moving toward cleaning up diesel, and 4.5 million is not a lot of money. So I'm not sure how much we'll get by that. But I do think this idea of switching out, working with buildings, right, in the Bay Area, because a lot of jurisdictions need help and funding. Truckers are going to invest in new tech. Truckers are going to buy new trucks over time, and the state's really pushing, trying to come up with ways and incentivizing. We may get more bang for our buck by using this and leveraging funds from local governments to help them, make some of their buildings more energy efficient or working. And I like that you've encouraged partnerships with nonprofits and community-based organizations. So having this grant also leverage other funds makes the money go that much farther. And I know there's a lot of local government folks that would like to make their buildings more energy efficient, and which reduces GHGs, and need some help in funding. Or, frankly, a city working with a nonprofit on that as well. So those are some concepts. The leveraging, co-benefits, helping those who don't have capacity apply, focusing on achievable reductions and care communities.
One thing I would strongly recommend relative to this particular grant funding source would be that you not focus it on those transportation or mobile sources, principally because those sources won the lottery this year. We're going to be coming back to you to talk to you in October and through Mobile Source and some other committees about the funding that we've got there. We will have in our grant program pretty much dedicated to those mobile sources and going electric up to or close to $100 million over the next year. So our $4.5 million, I think, should be focused somewhere else. So that's a point well taken.
Yeah, no, because I think there is opportunities in the mobile sector, whereas there's not necessarily money allocated for, let's say, local governments to help them retrofit buildings.
No, there isn't.
Hopefully there will be with more cap and trade funding. But there seems to be the more emphasis on state buildings right now, isn't there?
Yeah, through TIO, we were actually uncovering some things that are happening through the power companies, not the municipal utilities or the CCEs, but There are some rebates available there, and there are also some other programs that are, again, it's this matchmaking idea where there are some there is some funding that I think we can make folks aware of that they may, especially on the weatherization side, that might make the difference there. But this idea of concentrating, as Abby had said, on either changing. Taking natural gas out of buildings or making the natural gas system more efficient, using it for combined heat and power, those types of things I think can make a big difference in both reducing emissions and reducing costs for those facilities.
And one last point, I'm not sure we need to put as much in the EV infrastructure as we did before, because three things are happening. The Volkswagen settlement has forced them to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on this in California. The PUC approval to let PG&E put in, you know, rate base, putting in EV chargers. And then the development of, you know, this emphasis of this developing a model ordinance, which is built on the state green building code to require new development to pay for EV chargers. So you have new development, hopefully paying for EV chargers. You've got Volkswagen and the utilities, you know, investing hundreds of millions of dollars in new EV chargers, and then maybe seeing where the gaps are. I'm not saying they're still not funding, but I don't think before we were like the major ones out there in the region trying to fund EV chargers. Now there's a lot of other funding out there for them. So we may not need our funding to do that.
Director Ross.
Thank you, Chair Barrett. I just want to preface this by what I'm about to say doesn't mean that we shouldn't do all we can here in the Bay Area, but the Bay Area is 0.1% of the world's population, so it may not be so much what we do as much as how we do it and exporting that knowledge elsewhere, which would have a potentially much greater effect. And so I like that we're looking for something replicable and applicable to governments that who need the help and need the efficiencies that hopefully these will provide, that strategies will provide. And yeah, we always want to invent something that's good, but innovation is always more cost effective and usually more attainable. So keep up the good work, Abby. I appreciate
it. Thank you. And I'd like to mention, Henry mentioned that we're having our webinar this tomorrow for local governments on the Solar Ordinance Toolkit. And we've got local governments from outside the Bay Area that have asked to join in on that. So I think that's a good example of how we're spreading our influence.
Yes.
Just, we've talked about it a couple times a day, the changing, trying to change over from natural gas to electricity. Talk to me about how, you know, the relative cost of running items by electricity and natural gas?
Well, I'm not sure I can give you a whole answer on that, but there it depends. And what we try to do is intervene at points of engagement, right? So, and one thing I wanted to add to Damian's comment about using this $4.5 million in a way where it will have a big effect. And part of the distinction, I think, between the Technology Implementation Office and what this grant program might do is that this grant program, it's not enough money to fund, you know, a lot of new the actual technologies. No. So what this program may focus on is more the strategic policies and programs that can be put in place that facilitate that switch. And in terms of what are the cost benefits of different, natural gas, dryers versus electric dryers, yes. Natural gas, water heaters versus, electric heaters. And a lot of that, of course, relates to the changes and fluctuations in the natural gas and the electricity market. So right now we have fairly low natural gas prices compared to electricity. So, you know, it's a little harder to get those to pencil out, but these things are always changing. What we're trying to do is facilitate the shift. So for example, when a homeowner or a property owner is faced with all of a sudden needing to change a water heater, that's not the time when they go on the internet and spend a few hours trying to figure out what's the carbon low carbon option.
Yeah.
What we want to do is have policies and responses in place in communities so that when they start finding the one vendor that's open Saturday morning, that vendor is prepared to give them the low carbon options and all the financing information that they need. So it's that piece that we think we might be able to do with this relatively small amount of money.
So it's the education and preparing the area for knowing what to do when you need a new
when you need to make that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That could certainly be part of it, right?
Okay.
So it's very similar to what we did on the EV side. We didn't tell government jurisdictions to go out and install EV chargers. What we told them is fix your permitting so when someone comes into you with one of these devices, you can get them out the door within 8 hours or no permit review and those types of things. It's those type of policy and structure that either local government can put in place or businesses can put in place so that, as Abby said, when it comes to decision choice, is it gas or is it electric? That's always going to be a choice. That's always going to be a choice based on what's most cost efficient and what can actually get you the best emissions reductions. But if there isn't a green building ordinance in place or there isn't a plan or there isn't staff to actually do that, none of those choices may actually get made because they might just go, well, we've worked with this for the last 10 years. It works.
Let's I know
just
this works. This
and go. Yeah.
Thank you.
Director Abacoka.
Thank you, and thank you for the presentation. It's always exciting to hear about grant programs and resources that are available. I would echo Director Sinks' comments about some of our local agencies like Clean Energy needing the expertise that you provide. Even
cities, right?
And I was going to say, even in our city, we've engaged in sustainability for several years now, and we have a plan that we update and kind of come to the point where we've taken all the low-hanging fruit and now we're moving to the next level. But we need help in terms of like where's the biggest bang for our buck, and so in terms of measurements of where can we get the most GHG emission reductions for the least amount of money is what we're looking at. And we're actually engaging a citizen task force because our community has been very active, and we'll probably be asking for your help in some of the technical pieces to that. But in terms of, I appreciate that the focus on existing buildings, definitely local, our own government buildings, where we're looking at how we're going to retrofit those. But one area, and I remember a few years back, it was under President Obama, and we had the energy CDBG grants, and at that time, one area where we provided funding was for affordable housing projects to retrofit, and so when we look at when I think about care communities and multifamily developments, and then talking about where is the greater need, and like some as Director Joya mentioned, I think I look at maybe that as an area that we could focus on. Because funding resources are usually limited for affordable housing developments to do these upgrades. So if you could maybe look at that, that would be a great area to focus, I would say. But other than that, in terms of innovative strategies, I was just thinking, I think we are probably fortunate in our community to sort of, we have staff, we have now 1.5 staff, but your timeline and innovation, I'm not quite sure if even at, our staffed level, and maybe I'm underestimating our staff person, but given the amount of work that I know he has, I'm not quite sure if we can get there that quickly. And so it might mean, you know, more of your assistance, but also just, yeah, the timeline. I appreciate being aggressive on one hand, but I kind of wonder if it's too aggressive, frankly, from a local government perspective. So that's my thoughts.
Director Rice?
Yes, I actually was focused on the timeline as well, and not only in terms of staff being ready to get to work on something so quickly, but also in terms of our budget and work plan cycles, which usually begin, I think, more development in the spring, and are working on a June. So I thought you should be giving some look to this, to the timeline for this, and frankly, I think getting feedback from the municipalities would be helpful on that. And then I do think that the point around having funding available that helps us, helps local jurisdictions provide a local match that leverages other outside grant fundings is really that could fit in, frankly, into our focus areas, makes sense. And again, given that those grant opportunities come in at varying times during the year, I'm wondering if we might not want to think about some sort of set-aside pot of this larger $4.5 million that it's available at a later time. So those were my thoughts.
Yeah. You know, in listening to a lot of this discussion, it seems to me, I mean, we all want to see tangible, real benefits to people who live in the Bay Area, right? I mean, it's great to reduce GHGs, but that's why the co-benefits part is so important. And so, you know, and the leveraging. It seems that there's a lot of local government sort of programs, but not enough money to help lower-income residents do energy improvements. It seems that having some component of this be used to and leverage again other local funding, where local governments often even work with community-based organizations. So you're getting tangible GHG reductions, energy improvements in people's homes, which lowers their energy bills. You know, we're obviously using less fossil fuels. And you're leveraging local government funding, and you're working with lower income residents, often in care communities or throughout the Bay Area. It seems to me that, I mean, no, just in being in local government, knowing that there is a need for more funding there, that's a component that could be very beneficial and, frankly, benefit a lot of people.
I just think that the dollar amount here is so low that...
No, you're right. Yeah. I'm not saying... But this is the leveraging factor. If you develop, let's say, a component... Yeah. You're working on it with local government, and you know, and so you're encouraging them to put some money into the pot as well. So between this money, you know, whether it's a match, whatever, you're bringing in other money to the table to develop a program.
Well, let us go back and take a look at that and see, you know, how best. I think we get the point that the leveraging is important, and this issue of making impacts in the care communities. Let's take a look and see how best we can balance that.
And it gets co-benefits, right? I mean, Mark's point, which is, you know, we are a very small part of the world GHG, which is why the gold standard is you get the GHG reductions and co-benefits, you know, the other benefits.
So, yeah, I'm kind of at the point, listen to everybody, where I think I'm thinking about, you know, I talked about our community energy agency and being in its infancy in terms of thinking about program. I'm kind of thinking that you may actually, this agency may have more expertise in which programs are cost effective and score better. You may have a lot more sophistication than our sustainability commissions, citizens groups. Frankly, where we also have, you know, folks who may have some self-interest, right? They come in, they're running a solar business or this business or... Yeah, it usually is the case, right? So given the level of expertise in this agency, maybe the right idea is to leverage the dollars rather than just giving us, as it were, block grants, right? Thinking about the federal, what's going on at the federal government. these days. Maybe the right idea is to give us incentives that leverage money that we already have, like, yeah, the program money for community choice energy, where you've already helped us sort out where the most effective, well, Margaret said it, right? The biggest bang for the buck in terms of metric equivalents of CO2. And then, you know, four and a half is going to go real fast. So, but it could leverage maybe 10 times that much. And yes, it could be focused on care communities disproportionately. I think that makes sense too.
Well, with that in mind, Director Sinks, that leveraging and those interconnections may take us a little bit longer to actually work out.
I think that's okay.
Well, we want to get a sense, I think, from you all. If we were to go on that path, would there be a possibility of delaying this program, pushing it out a little bit further, maybe?
Yeah.
I think we heard that smart. From a couple of the directors.
And if you did it this other way.
Head shaking or head nodding.
Right. It's like especially the cities that don't have funding to have a grant officer to hop on whatever we put out, you know, they may struggle anyway with this timing. So I think we could lead in you know, suggesting programs that might leverage these other dollars. Thanks.
Okay. So thank you, Abby, for your presentation and the good discussion up here.
Pardon me, Madam Chair. We have a speaker on this item.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. Okay, open public comment.
Janet Stromberg.
Hello again. This time I have my hat on as a member of the Berkeley Energy Commission, and this is super timely because tonight I'm in a meeting with a subcommittee where we're going to talk about funding building decarbonization incentive programs in Berkeley. And from my perspective, building decarbonization includes energy efficiency. And to answer the question that's been raised, I think it's pretty well understood that energy efficiency improvements actually give the biggest bang for the buck. And with regard to your comments, Director Joya, I really appreciate your reiterating attention to the more impacted people, the people who are poorer, because not only would they save money, I think the house is more comfortable. Your home is more comfortable when you have energy efficiency because you can almost feel the drafts, even if you're paying more for the gas. So I suspect that the whole program can address that, and probably that's true. One thing I would say, I'm really excited about the direction that our Energy Commission is going in terms of thinking about building decarbonization, and the conclusion we've come to is that the first easy, though expensive, element is the water heating. And we have a community that has rich and poor and everything in between. For the more affluent people, we suspect that even a fairly small incentive would tilt people that are inclined to be first adopters, people that have bought their Teslas already, to start going with expensive but electric water heating. But I think that any program needs to address the whole spectrum, as you've mentioned. So I would invite you, in particular, since we have this forum right here, if you're from cities, represent cities that are thinking about building decarbonization, I would like to dialogue with your citizen commissions about approaches and maybe what we come up with in Berkeley. We were actually thinking of funding our own incentive program, so it would just be icing on the cake to apply. I'm sure Berkeley will be applying for something, but we're also looking at how we could fund these kinds of things. So I would enjoy working with representatives of your cities in that level. Thanks.
Can I make a comment about you raise an interesting point, which made me think here, is that when we do this, you know, you may have one program where low-income residents, you know, get it fully paid for, let's say through local government and the grant, and then a component of it in which our money is a small part of incentivizing someone who has the funds to actually make the change, right? So you can structure it, because this whole leverage idea and getting benefit. I mean, there's a part of me that says that, you know, funding these big programs and yes, we want innovation, and innovation, there's so much state investment in new innovation too, is that we have a responsibility to really, see residents in the Bay Area have a tangible difference in their quality of life from this funding. And I do think we need to focus in that way. But so you can structure the program like you said, and some people get a small contribution, some get it fully paid for, depending on their means.
I think you have to look out for Proposition 218 on that, but I'm sure you'll look into that.
Is there a Prop 218 issue on this?
Using public funds in, not
for incentive really, program. Well,
I just think it's something that they need to look
at. I think all the time we give more funding for lower income residents as an incentive than a higher income resident. I don't think. Well, we'll check. I'm not aware that that's an issue, but yeah, it's worth checking.
Thank you. Okay, so public comment is closed, and we will move on to committee member comments and other business. Are there any other committee comments? People seem all spoken out. Okay. Yes, also, would you be able to give us the webinar information in a timely fashion so that if any of our staff want to be part of that, we could?
Absolutely. We'll get that email out to you today.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Since it is tomorrow, you said, right?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Okay, time and place of next meeting is Thursday, November 16th. And I think with that, we're adjourned. Thank you, staff.